Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with me. For many non-Muslim New Yorkers, halal food means food carts that are scattered, mostly in Manhattan, that serve lamb and chicken over rice with salad, white sauce, hot sauce. Delicious. It's a huge part of New York street food, and the iconic Halal Guy vendors are even taking their carts global. But halal food is so much more than that. There's a new book called Halal Food, A History, and its authors are Phoebe Armanios, Associate Professor of History at Middlebury. Welcome, Phoebe.
Thank you, Allison.
And Boach Arganay, Professor of History at the University of Vermont. Thanks for being with us, Boach.
Hi.
So it's the most basic question, but I'm curious, what made you write this book?
Well, we are we're both Vermonters, and in Vermont, food is a big deal. We're surrounded by farms and agriculture and a lot of happy cows. But more seriously, we both teach about elements of food in our classes. I teach a class on food in the Middle East, and Boach teaches a class about animals and Islam. And so the project kind of came out of this interaction with our students and a recognition that there isn't really an accessible book that explains from, you know, A to Z what halal food is. So we decided to partner up and take on this project.
We are also historians, and from a historical perspective, there's even less about how this notion of halal, especially halal food, evolved over time. So while we are interested in the notion of halal food, what seemed particularly fascinating to us is that how those rules changed over time, and what do they mean right now for modern circumstances?
When you started researching this and also interacting with your students, what were some of the misconceptions and misperceptions about halal food? The ones that made you laugh and also the ones that made you think, oh my goodness.
Well, one thing that really people think right off the bat, and less funny, I suppose, is that halal food is something that didn't change at all from beginning until now, that the rules are identical now to what they were in the 7th century when they came about. And so something to interact with our students and to explain to them is that it's a dynamic concept, that there are rules that come out of the religious scriptures, but that Muslims from the 8th and 9th centuries to the 21st centuries are interacting with new food ingredients, new items, and making decisions based on their religious texts about whether it's permissible or not permissible.
In addition to that, among our students and in general audience, they were particularly curious about the parallels and differences between halal regulations and kosher ones. So that was one aspect of the topic that we found ourselves explaining, learning about, first of all, and explaining. And part of our discussion also relates to attitudes towards animals. And this is one of the, by the way, most underexplored aspects of Islamic studies, Muslim attitudes towards animals. Since halal regulations, for the most part, relate to meat and slaughter, we learned a lot about that, too. And there's aspects of the discussion very, very pertinent to modern day, you know, animal welfare concerns, too. That's another interesting thing, especially for Western audiences.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a minute. One of the ways I thought was interesting, the way you organized the book, you decided not to go chronologically. You went by themes. Tell me about that choice.
Yeah, well, this is such a broad topic, and because we were trying to write an introductory text, we really thought that readers may want to go into it and not necessarily even read it all in one sitting, but kind of be curious about particular topics that make the news when it comes to halal. So something like slaughter, or something like eating out, like the halal food guys that you mentioned, the halal guys. So, you know, this, the way we came at it is what would be the most accessible and thematic, ultimately ended up being the easiest way to organize material that relates to the historical period and material that's relevant for readers today, to combine both in every single chapter.
We don't expect our readers to read the book in one sitting, and we wanted from the get-go individual chapters to be to some extent self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. Since the topic is so broad, one person who's interested in industrial applications of halal should be able to read that relevant chapter. And perhaps, you know, if that person has interest in cuisine later, a couple of weeks later, that person might sit down and read those chapters too. So the thematic kind of approach has those kind of advantages.
Well, we're going to dive in, pardon the pun, to the book, Halal Food, A History. Chapter one is about overview and certification, but I think we should just define terms. That halal means, and please correct me, it means lawful?
Exactly.
So when I see halal as an adjective to apply in front of food, what does that actually mean?
It is a designation applied to whatever that comes after the term, indicating that that particular substance, in the case of, you know, dietary practices, that food is permissible for consumption. It is it refers to except general in legal terms acceptability of that particular dietary item or practice.
And it stands in contrast to another word that we see less often, but we talk about in our book, which is haram, which is what is impermissible. So food, and not just food, but behavior and economic transactions and all kinds of things that Muslims must do in their day-to-day life are categorized in Islamic law as permissible and impermissible. And then there are also, when it comes to food, some designations that fall even in between.
Which we should not get into. It gets really complicated for the purposes of this discussion.
So in theory, could I use halal as an adjective
yes.
in front of anything?
Right.
Yes.
For example, there's halal finance, right? Certain financial transactions mm-hmm. that, according to Islamic law, acceptable, permitted, sanctioned. There are also haram financial transactions that Islamic law considers as impermissible. Marriage practices, divorce practices, it's haram or halal. They are either accepted or permissible or non-accepted, not accepted or impermissible in general.
So, go ahead, please.
And also, we see it today in pharmaceuticals or in makeup. So we see a movement now to also designate and use and identify this terminology when it comes to other items beyond food. We don't cover all of that in our book. We focus strictly on food. But there is a movement to engage more with what is permissible and impermissible in just about every aspect of daily life for Muslims.
In terms of food, what were the original halal? Is rules the right word to use? The original rules?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Quran, which is the holy scripture for Muslims, is pretty clear about the prohibitions against specific items. And these are pork and blood. And the term that's often used in English is carrion. Carrion referring to meat that's not slaughtered in a religiously sanctioned way. And then there are also additional prohibitions against alcohol.
And Quran is very clear about that. There are these four or five items, and later developments in Islamic history is very much a product of Muslim jurists, Muslim legal minds, thinking about these Quranic prescriptions and trying to apply those prescriptions to their daily lives as Islam spread and encountered different populations and cultures.
To what to that point, what you mentioned earlier, Phoebe, this idea that it can be dynamic. These rules are dynamic and they are continuing to evolve. Are there any specific moments or milestones where the rules have evolved and really made a shift and made a difference?
Yeah, a really good example that we raise in the book that people don't often think about because it's also so pervasive is coffee. When coffee was introduced to the Middle East and the Islamic world, and it is born out of Ethiopia and then came to the Middle East through Yemen and then into Arabia and other parts of the regions, Muslims weren't really sure what to make of the substance. Does it have intoxicating effects? It keeps you up all day. It really does affect and alter them. It's a mind-altering substance.
It's a stimulant, yeah.
It's a stimulant, right? So how do they categorize it? And the debates that they had used in earlier centuries to discuss alcohol prohibitions actually now came into play when it came to coffee. And they went on for a fairly long time until, as you know, if you've ever been to those regions in the Middle East, they really are fond of really strong coffee. Mm-hmm. those went in the favor of definitely pro-coffee. But there are others, too.
There is tobacco as well. And the operation of Islamic legal thinking is interesting there, right? Neither tobacco nor coffee are mentioned in the Quran. These are relatively new substances in Muslim settings, especially in the Middle East. What Quran includes or contains are prescriptions regarding alcohol. So the idea is that to what extent we can apply these prescriptions regarding alcohol to these other substances, which may or may not be considered as psychoactive, essentially. And we see different jurisprudential treatments of those substances. Some jurists came to argue that, you know, what we find in the Quran regarding alcohol might be applicable. And others came to the argument that no, they are not applicable because the kind of psychoactivity we are talking about, tobacco and coffee when they're involved, is different the kind of psychoactivity, essentially. And what we see here is a kind of proliferation proliferation of plurality, right? It's not strictly, you know, this particular substance, everybody agrees they are haram or halal. What we see, in fact, is a plurality of opinions. And that's exactly the way in other areas of law, too. Islamic law demonstrates the plurality and plasticity of its nature.
Well, we've discussed the elasticity of it and how it can morph and change. But are there any hard and fast rules that something that is halal, food that is halal, must adhere to?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the prohibition against pork is really rigid, and incredibly strictly applied. Now, I'll just add one caveat to that, Allison. It's becoming a tiny bit more challenged in the modern period by way of one substance, which is gelatin. Now, gelatin, when you think about it, is produced from the cartilage, most commonly of pigs, oftentimes beef as well, and occasionally chicken, or often mixed up together. But in any case, there are porcine substances that make their way usually into gelatin. So the debate that's ensued in Muslim circles is whether a product that comes out of pork but looks nothing like it is edible, and it makes its way through all kinds of manufactured food. It's in yogurt, it's, you know, it's in cottage cheese, it's in a stabilizer used in a variety of items. So what to make of it? Is it halal? Do you apply that hard rule that was so clear for centuries to this one item, or is there flexibility because it went through a kind of industrialized process?
What makes the prohibition against pork rigid is the fact that it is specifically mentioned in the Quran. So there isn't much room for speculation there. The Quran says that don't eat this. So jurists are not in the position of going against that prescription. But Phoebe is absolutely right. What happens to this pork-based substance, which may or may not be used in medicine? What's the status of that? Are there kind of ways in which we can accommodate that? Those are the issues that are, in fact, that have been occupying the minds of the legal-minded, observant Muslims in modern days.
My guests are Phoebe Armanios and Boach Argane. He gave me the thumbs up on that. The name of their book is Halal Food, A History. So the next chapters, 2 through 4, 5, 6, talk about modern food production and attitudes towards meat and alcohol. When you talk about alcohol, is there any room for interpretation?
Yeah. Well, for many Muslims, no. And many Muslims today, that's a clear-cut no. But when you go back to the historical sources, there are conversations being had by the most esteemed Muslim jurists of their day in the medieval centuries to talk about, you know, what the place of alcohol is. The Quran has specific verses that seem to, you know, have a nuance to them. The Quran prohibits intoxication and speaks very overtly against wine made from grapes. So the question among jurists then becomes whether this applies more broadly to other all intoxicants and other substances that are not wine made from grapes, or whether it's specifically fixed to those particular items.
The Quran also tells Muslims to be easy on themselves, make life easy for yourself. So and that's an important kind of prescription, because what if one of the uses of the of alcohol is medical, right? And there are instances in which, not only in Islamic culture, but in many other pre-modern religious communities, there are instances of use of alcohol for medical purposes. And that kind of opens the door for, you know, some Muslim jurists to kind of use certain types of alcohol in certain circumstances. And we see in that particular instance a great deal of variation in Muslim attitudes towards alcohol. And this is an important point, actually, for people who are trying to understand Islam. When we are talking about Islam, we are not only specifically talking about Islamic law. Islam is a civilizational kind of description, a label. And Islamic law represents only one layer of that civilization. So in a sense, it's important for people like us who are trying to understand Islam to kind of, you know, see that Islamic discourse as layers of different kind of scripts. There's a legal script, there's a medical script, there's a script about entertainment, manliness. Mm-hmm. And we see all these different attitudes towards alcohol in these scripts kind of coming together, creating a complex environment that, you know, there aren't any right or, strictly speaking, acceptability or unacceptability, you know, representing certain kinds of alcohol. Phoebe is absolutely right about the fact that many Muslim jurists will consider alcohol, at least in certain uses, unacceptable. But there are also opinions about alcohol that may be more lenient because of this complex situation.
What has been the impact of modern food production and modern attitudes towards food production, specifically, for example, I should say, the way to raise animals humanely? What has been the impact of this on halal food?
Well, Muslims are engaging in the last 30 years or so in some really interesting discussions about what kind of food they ought to be considering strictly halal. And that comes from a several Quranic verses that say effectively, eat what is halal and what is good. And the word good in Arabic is tayyib, and it can be translated also as wholesome, as flavorful. And for modern Muslims, they can also take it to mean all kinds of things. Good is something ethical. Good can be something healthy, yeah. Right? And so when you take the term ethical, then you have certain groups, and especially this is a phenomenon we see in non-Muslim countries, so North America and in European countries, who are becoming more engaged in considering the source of animals, the meat that they're eating, or were the animals treated humanely in life, were they fed or not antibiotics or hormones, or animal byproducts in their feed. And even beyond animals, they're talking about whether the vegetables they're eating are GMO or sprayed with, toxic chemicals. And so the idea is eat what is halal and what is good means what is good for the body. And this can even go further. And to add another script to what Boaz says, the health script, is it healthy? So is eating high fat, high salt, greasy food necessarily fitting with this within this mandate of eating halal and good, right? And for some, it's not. It's actually try to be more conscientious ethically, but also in terms of how to treat your body in a healthful way. So it's a very interesting reinterpretation or reexamination of a classical verse in the Quran that's now having new meaning for activists and ethically minded Muslims.
And for foodies, the idea you've read about halal cuisine as opposed to halal food. Would you mm-hmm. explain that for folks to watch? Or Phoebe's like, I'm going for that one.
So halal cuisine is such an interesting phenomenon for us. We actually talked a lot about how to engage with it in the book. And it's a term that's being used by Muslims more and more, I would say, the last 10 or 15 years. And the idea here is really, how do you think of halal beyond just the legal category, but as almost like an ethnic food category? And then if you're thinking about it that way, what ethnic food does it provoke? So let's take it to the New York setting with the halal food carts, right? And often that food might evoke a kind of loosely Middle Eastern or South Asian inspired cuisine, right? But can we think of halal cuisine in the UK as fish and chips? That's halal, right? Or coq au vin in France, that's also halal. Is that part of the halal cuisine repertoire?
Is it?
And yeah, for many people who are playing around with this terminology, who are Muslim foodies or cookbook authors or blog writers, and they're becoming more vocal in talking about cuisine and defining what cuisine is, they would absolutely argue it is. They would say it's living by the standards of your religious rules and by the laws that your religion dictates, but also acclimating to the culture in which you live and being able to participate in the food that it offers in all of its varieties, right? So it's finding a marriage between these two things that is evoking this idea of halal cuisine. But I would say it's still a work in progress about how to define it.
It is. And it makes sense completely in places like United States or Canada or Western Europe. But in many Muslim majority countries, the notion is still not out there, essentially. And it is only in this incredibly globalized settings, context, this idea of halal cuisine makes sense, both people who are not part of the Muslim community, but Muslims themselves. Mm-hmm. They are developing a Muslim identity independent of their local origins, essentially. And that makes sense in New York, but not perhaps in many Middle Eastern settings.
Boaz, in our last minutes, what would you want someone to understand about halal food that we haven't discussed yet, that you think is important?
It is an expression of identity for many Muslims. Mm. It is an expression of identity in the sense that many Muslims find themselves, especially in places like New York, in, you know, big cities, urban metropolitan areas, for people who are experiencing this sense of globalization, but at the same time want to express that, experience that globalization by connecting it to their own identities. And desire, the yearning for halal food, and not only food, but halal relationships. And in fact, it's a kind of reaching back to their identity, religious identities, kind of grasping them and engage that globalization from that perspective. It's a desire for local identity in that global setting. And I think that is a really, really underappreciated aspect of halal.
Yeah, I also think it's becoming a fascinating entry point by which non-Muslims can understand Muslim culture and traditions. So when you have it displayed, the label halal, in restaurants and in food carts and in other settings, in places where people may not be familiar with that, you know, it's an invitation to non-Muslims to ask questions about what this means, about what's behind this, what are these traditions, and to connect with this other cultural tradition in a way they may not otherwise have a chance to, especially in our world today. It creates an interesting opportunity for food to act as a mediator between different religions and communities and peoples that maybe other items and you know, categories cannot function today.
The name of the book is Halal Food, A History. Phoebe Armanios and Boach Ergene, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with the origin story of glitter. You heard that right. Glitter. More after a break. You're listening to All of It from WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. What is glitter? One answer is the legendarily bad Mariah Carey movie, but that's not what we're talking about. The answer New York Times writer Katie Weaver was looking for when she went into the search for the origins of the tiny, shiny stuff. Her investigation revealed as many questions as answers, and it also revealed a dark side of glitter, a.k.a., can you say it for me, aluminum metallized?
I have never said it out loud. Polyethylene
terephthalates. That's what it is.
PET is really what it is.
PET. Katie Weaver from the New York Times joined us. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
So what inspired you to go down the glitter rabbit hole?
Well, I would say I am a very tacky person, so I like glitter. And I would say I became really aware of it a couple of years ago because I have a friend who banned it from her apartment. And I had never met anyone who hated glitter as much as she did. And she, you know, made me realize that it is in so many things because she's like, that card can't come in my apartment. That nail polish can't come in my apartment. Because once it gets in, it really never gets out. And then a little before Thanksgiving of 2018, I just happened to be watching a YouTube video of recycling, like industrial recycling. And then I said, you know what, I would rather see glitter being made. And once I clicked into that, I said, I have no idea how glitter is made. So I asked my editor at the Times if I could figure that out. And she just said, yep.
Wow. Well, as you can see, I showed you my phone case.
Yes, beautiful.
And it's quite
stunning.
Glittery, sparkly. Is there an origin? What's the origin of the word glitter?
Oh, gosh. I knew this at one point during my research. I can't remember off the top of my head now, but I do know that glitter as, you know, the kind of arts and craft product that we're talking about, is very recent. It doesn't seem to have really existed before the 1940s. And before that, people would use the word glitter, but they were referring to an intangible light effect. And I was really surprised by that because I assumed that glitter had been around for centuries, but it seems to have been developed actually just around World War II. And before then, my theory is that we didn't have the technology to cut anything so small that we even needed a distinct word to describe these teeny, teeny, tiny sparkly particles. We could just, you know, describe them using words that already existed.
And you make a case in your piece that we are wired to like glitter, that we as human beings like glittery things. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I think it's because my theory that I kind of came up with independently, and then I was able to luckily find some scientific articles to back this up, is that it has to do with our natural attraction to water, fresh water, because I was just wondering, you know, once glitter was invented, it really went everywhere. So there has to be something in it that is appealing to people on a very mass scale. So it has to be something kind of intrinsic in us. And I just thought, you know, what looks like glitter in nature? Water is really the only thing I could think of. And there have been a few studies that have examined this, and one of them involved studying babies as they licked plates to see, are they more likely to lick plates that are shiny or is it different colors? And babies love licking shiny plates, it turns out. So maybe that's why we like glitter. Yeah, I don't know.
What is glitter made of? The stuff that we think about now, today.
Mm-hmm. So most of it is made of plastic, not all of it, but a lot of it is made of PET. And then they call it metallized. So they, through a process I barely understand, kind of apply aluminum to it. And at that point, I think it's also technically mylar, like the inside of a potato chip bag or those space blankets that they put around marathoners at the end of a race. Mm-hmm. And then they can treat it in other ways. They can color it. They can etch tiny patterns into it that make it holographic. And then they just cut it down tiny, tiny, tiny. But it is essentially mostly plastic.
And who are the they in this conversation?
Well, in my story, they are GlitterX, which is a company based in New Jersey. I was shocked to find out that most of the glitter that appears in at least, you know, the name brand products that we encounter in the U.S. comes from the U.S. It seems to be mostly made in New Jersey, not all of it, but the vast majority. And then if you're maybe buying, you know, Christmas decorations at the dollar store, that is not necessarily from New Jersey. That might be coming from overseas. But GlitterX has been making glitter for decades. I spoke to a father and son there, Babu Shetty and his son, Jeet, who now, you know, make the glitter. It's like, time to make the glitter, time to make the donuts. And they very sweetly tried to explain to a very non-scientific person the intense, like, chemical engineering process that is required to make glitter. I would say I walked away with maybe like a 30% understanding of how it's made, but I could not believe how complicated it was. And even before I went, they said, you will not, you know, people have no idea how hard it is to actually make glitter, how much is involved.
We're talking to Katie Weaver from the New York Times about her piece, What is Glitter? It was fascinating, your piece, that the people who are in the glitter biz are quite secretive.
Mm-hmm.
They are not willing to give up the glitter secrets.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about trying to actually report this story and some of the obstacles you faced.
I thought I was going to email one of these companies, say, hey, I'm from the New York Times and I'd like to write about glitter. And they were going to say, oh, welcome, and roll out the red carpet. I got so many no's, or we don't make glitter in the U.S. I couldn't believe how secretive it was. And actually, the people who I ended up speaking to at GlitterX initially also told me no. And I just kept kind of begging them and really trying to explain where I was coming from. And I said, you know, I'm not trying to give away trade secrets or anything. And they finally consented to let me come down to the factory and just talk to them and see if maybe they would even tell me enough to write a story, because they didn't. They said, you know, we know what we'll tell you. We don't know if you're going to think you have enough after we tell you what we can. So I went down to the factory. They showed me all that. They basically showed me everything that they could show to a client, all of the samples, and they kind of explained the process, but they would not let me actually see it being made. And they said that a big reason for the secrecy is that their clients insist on it because they make glitter for some of the biggest companies in the world. And apparently, it makes sense. These people don't want their competitors to know exactly what kind of glitter they're using in their products, because they could, in theory, just make identical products. So it was...
Oh, so it's an intellectual property issue in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You finally got them to tell you at least one company.
Yes.
And that apparently took you a long time. So who's the company that you were able to say uses GlitterX's glitter, and how do they use it?
Revlon. how they use it, I do not know. My guess would be it's probably in their nail polish. Mm-hmm. But, you know, glitter can appear in many different forms of makeup. A lot of makeup also uses mica, which is a naturally sparkly particle. But I can say definitively that Revlon uses GlitterX glitter some way, somehow.
And it was really a funny exchange, as you were just desperately trying to get this woman to explain, to tell you who some of the clients are. Tell us a little bit how glitter is colored. It's really interesting.
Oh, okay. So, well, what I found the most interesting was how they can put different kind of rainbow effects on it. And I was shocked to learn the difference between holographic and iridescent. And holographic involves actually etching a pattern onto the plastic film, which becomes glitter. to change how the light bounces back off it, so it kind of creates a rainbow effect. But iridescence involves layering different, I don't even have the word to describe it, layering something in very, very, very thin, thin, thin layers that change, and they all have different refractive indexes, so it changes how it, you know, falls on the visual spectrum or something. You could tell as I'm talking about it. And I have researched this so carefully. I spent hours doing this. I still barely understand it. That's why it is made by, you know, literal, like, chemical engineering scientists. But yeah, it's just, I have no idea how glitter is made, basically, after doing this story.
You both understand it and don't understand, yes, at the same time. So what are some other products that glitter is in besides that we think of glitter that comes out of, you know, like a confetti cannon or New Year's Eve? Where else is glitter?
Oh, if you just look around, I was actually thinking today, where have I already seen it today? I saw it on a decorative sticker for my cell phone. I saw it in nail polish. It's in greeting cards. It's on wrapping paper. I recently, to my boyfriend's horror, bought a pair of pants online that were like glitter pants. And I said, oh, these will be pretty. I got gold glitter everywhere. And I took them out of the bag and immediately put them back in. It's already everywhere in our apartment. I didn't even wear them.
Were you able to find any solution to why glitter does that?
Yes. Okay. And it actually relates into a tip for cleaning it up. So apparently it clings because of static electricity. And so a good way to clean it up and combat that is to use dryer sheets. So I spent last weekend frantically dryer sheetsing our whole apartment. But I couldn't believe how well it worked. So if you ever have a glitter spill, get dryer sheets. You'll be shocked at how efficiently it picks it up.
We're talking to New York Times writer Katie Weaver about her piece, What is Glitter? All right. We're going to talk about the dark side of the shiny stuff. Glitter is everywhere, it stays everywhere, which means it's in the environment and it is in the water. Right. What are some of the concerns about glitter environmentally?
Well, this was actually an interesting thing to research because I had seen a bunch of stories about, you know, glitter being bad for the environment. And the more I researched, I found that what we know is that glitter definitely is everywhere. The actual effects of it are not super well known. Microplastics, which glitter falls into that category, is still a fairly new field. So scientists are still trying to figure out, you know, what does it mean that we have all this glitter in our oceans? How much is even there? And it's also not just glitter. It's any teeny tiny plastic that breaks down. I spoke to a scientist for the story, and she told me that the bigger problem with glitter is actually that it is made from plastic. All plastics are bad because they are made from fossil fuels. And I think the phrase she used is, we're using very finite resource to make things that are completely disposable. And it's true. You don't make glitter so that it'll stand for 1,000 years. But turns out it will stand for 1,000 years, even after you think you've gotten rid of it.
Whether you want it to or not.
Right.
Are there any greener alternatives?
I know that there are some companies that make biodegradable glitter. Mm-hmm. I think they tend to be smaller scale. Mica is a naturally occurring kind of sparkly resource, but that also has a lot of problems in terms of how it's mined. A lot of it comes from India, and it's mined illegally by children, so that's not great
not
either.
Great. Tell me a little bit about something that just blew your mind in this piece, and something that didn't make it into the piece that you really wanted to.
Okay, well, I definitely have something that didn't make it into the piece. Everything about the story blew my mind. As you cut glitter down and make it smaller and smaller, it actually gets less sparkly, less glittery.
Oh, so there's like a glitter sweet spot.
So basically, yes. Yeah. So they explained to me how it happens, and we had to cut it from the piece because there was no super concise way for me to accurately describe what was happening. But it's essentially, if you can think of the film before it's cut or as it's cut as a cube, it has something to do with an edge that we can barely even perceive with our eyes that is not coated in the metallic shiny stuff. And as you cut it smaller and smaller, more of that edge is revealed, so it just looks less shiny, which to me was counterintuitive because I thought the smaller it is, the sparklier it'll be. But apparently that's not so.
I'm curious. You know, this is, I thought the story was hilarious. I loved reading it. I loved your investigation of it. But somebody might be thinking, like, why is the New York Times writing about glitter? What is this? So why did you think it really was kind of important to write a piece like this?
Oh, I just feel like nothing ever gets less interesting because you learn more about it. And I know that I am not special enough that if I have a question, no one else has ever had that same question. Like, if it occurs to me, it's occurred to millions of other people. And I am just lucky enough to be in a position where, you know, I can get paid to actually waste hours of my day looking this up and then begging people to let me come find out. So, yeah, I just wanted to tell people because I thought it's definitely someone else has wondered, like, what is glitter?
What's your next investigation?
Oh, my gosh. I have no idea. It'll probably occur to me as I'm walking out of the office today. I'll
All
just
right.
see something.
Well, I hope you'll come back next time you figure out your next what is.
Thank you. I'd love to.
Oh, Ashley, you have a new style letter coming out?
Oh, yes, we have a
Please
new newsletter.
Tell me about it.
Okay. So it's called Wait, and it's actually sort of in the vein of this story. I do waste a lot of time at work and interrupt my colleagues just kind of falling down these rabbit holes of like, do you guys know what glitter is? And then I will independently research for hours as everyone else is working on breaking news. And so I think they decided that we need to monetize all this time that I'm wasting by having me occasionally publish what I am learning, you know, books worth of information about. So the idea is that it's a weekly newsletter. Well, I will just investigate one topic entirely of my choosing. They will not be related. It'll just be kind of what distracted me this week. So it's called Wait, because I'm always like, wait, what is glitter?
We look forward to Wait.
Yes.
Katie Weaver, thank you so much. You can read her piece in full on the New York Times website. It's called What is Glitter? Coming up next on All of It, we're going to get the scoop on this year's CES conference, formerly called the Consumer Electronics Show, that just wrapped up in Vegas with tech writer Lance Olenoff. Stay with us.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on. Go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on. Get paid.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Today is the final day of the Gee Whiz Look at That conference in Vegas. Well, that's the way I think about it anyway. Its official name is the CES conference, formerly known as the Consumer Electronics Show, and it's been going on all week. It's an event where some of the game-changing tech that has changed your life has been seen for the first time. In 1970, the VCR was first shown there. In 1981, it was the compact disc player. In 1998, it was HDTV. So what's next? Let's ask Lance Olenoff, the upgrade tech columnist for Medium, who spent some quality time at CES this year. Hi, Lance. Welcome to All of It.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Lance, you called this year's CES a, quote, off year. Why?
Well, you kind of made the case for it because, and it's not big news. So for years we haven't had that product moment, that thing that we're going to keep talking about, that breakthrough. But this year in particular, I mean, I saw a ton of stuff, but I'm struggling to remember a single gadget where I was like, oh, well, that'll, you know, when that comes out in spring, we're just going to go crazy for it. There was a lot of interesting things, but, probably one of the bigger stories was sort of a technology that will underpin everything, you know, 5G technology, the faster broadband connectivity that's coming. Probably this is its big year, but we had companies, you know, automotive companies talking about it, chip manufacturers talking about it, and everybody's trying to use it to work together to not just make phone calls faster or video stream faster, but to do important work like a car that can talk to other cars and that can also talk to the street signs and the lights and potentially save lives. So that's a big story, but it's also hard, you know, for consumers to go, oh, wow, that's sexy.
You wrote in Medium about 5G. 5G weaves through many of the auto innovations planned for the coming years, but instead of enabling better calls and 4K streaming to a pair of backseat displays, Qualcomm, Toyota, Samsung, and others are positioning 5G as a digital safety net. What does that mean?
That's right. Well, as I said, so this is really, you know, when devices can communicate with each other. So the other big story of CES is the sort of automotive takeover, right? There's more and more cars there. But why are cars there? Because they're rolling computers with intelligence. But intelligence is really only as good as the information that it receives. And the way it's going to get a lot of this information in the coming years is through these big open pipes, this 5G channel that will instantaneously deliver information to a cluster of cars. So they know about how they're doing, how the cars around them are doing, situations in front, behind. They know about traffic signs. They know about the people around them. But the information moves at lightning speed, pretty much no matter how much it is.
So as you mentioned, cars were a big deal. What are some of the biggest changes coming to cars that you saw at CES?
Well, get ready to sit inside a spaceship, basically. I can't tell you how fascinating I was to see so many car companies and their partners show off dashboards that were nothing but displays. We are getting bigger displays in cars. If you look at a Tesla, a Model S, for example,
that thing is huge.
And so does the Model 3, is another big screen. But now, they're showing screens that are sort of an array that go where the usual place where you'd have plastic or something or fabric or rubber or anything. There's screen after screen after screen. And not only that, inside the cockpit of the car is watching you. One company showed off technology where the car is checking that you're not falling asleep. If you're distracted and tries to make you aware of that, and there's gesture control, and they don't even want, BMW wants to get rid of all the buttons in cars. They said they want to make it like a living room experience almost. And their concept car is sort of, it has seats that wrap to the sides. You can sit in a caddy corner. So, cars are technology. And, part of that has to do with the fact that the car buyer is changing. People are buying, they're not as interested in car ownership anymore. There's ride sharing. And, obviously we have more electric cars and more autonomous cars. So the experience of driving a car is becoming less about driving and more about sitting in a pod that's getting you from one place to another. And how do you feel about being in that pod?
Was there any discussion about privacy and car companies getting my data if the car is watching me or knowing exactly where I went and what time I got out and how much I weighed when I got back in the car?
Yes. They've been trained to say you weigh less and less every day. actually that conversation was consistent, that anytime somebody's talking about more intelligence, they were also talking about privacy. They would raise that because, we just came out of a year where we learned that our lives are not as private as we thought. And we know that regulation is probably coming this year. So you can't promise more intelligence and greater data gathering without also saying we promise to protect your privacy.
What about concerns, or were there concerns, I should say, about this idea of this inside of the spaceship being distracting to drivers?
Well, one demonstration I saw was talking about, that you make the selection for some show that you're going to watch. You make the selection in the front, and that's usually the passenger is doing that, but the video shows up in the back of the car. So they're not playing a movie up front. They're not trying to distract you. They're trying to make it so in cases where you're maybe not as focused on the road as you should be, or maybe you are doing something like trying to text, the car is actually going to be telling you, hey, look at the road. And by the way, cars are also going to be so smart that even if you're not, they're going to help you get out of an accident. Now, one thing I saw from Toyota that was really interesting is this marriage of intelligence and human engagement. So they're trying to split the difference between a human control and full autonomy. And they were showing how that can help people avoid accidents. And it was really fascinating to me because I kept wondering what that would feel like at the moment you're holding the steering wheel and trying to get around that car that suddenly darted out in front of you. Do you feel like a superhero driving because you seem to have more skill than ever? Or do you feel like you're in a struggle between you and the car?
Speaking with Lance Ulanoff, the Upgrade tech columnist for Medium, about CES 2019, let's go on to TV and phones. What's changing about TVs?
Well, everything's folding and rolling away. A year ago, LG showed me its rollable TV, and it was a fair distance from commercial availability. Well, this year they say it's coming, and they showed it. It was more polished. It looked better. Still rolls away into that box, which also houses the speakers, I should say. And it's all based on the power of OLED technology, which is an ultra thin, flexible screen. You just figure out how you want to back it. And what's interesting is that is, of course, bleeding out into smaller devices. Now, I don't know, a couple of months ago, Samsung teased the folding phone that it's working on. But there's a company, Royole, I think it's called R-O-Y-O-L-E, came out with FlexPay, which is a foldable phone, Android phone. And I saw it up close, and there it is. It's, you know, fold. If it's open, it looks like a 7-inch tablet. If it's folded, well, it's got a screen that wraps continuously all the way around. You know, this is not a phone show, but it, you know, shows things that you can do with phones or things that wrap around phones. Like, for example, there was an iPhone case that doubles as a drone. So, you know, you can.
Because who doesn't need that?
Phones, right. Of course, I need that.
The rollable TVs are crazy. They look like, I'm going to describe it sort of like when you get aluminum foil and you pull it out. That is,
I don't think there could be a better description. It's like the box is the giant roll of tin foil, but it's much more interactive. And it's cool because not only can it roll up and down, but you can roll it down partway and have this shallower screen that's just weather and news and photos, and it'll play. It's more just kind of an ambient experience. So this is not the end of the rollable TV experience. It's really the beginning, and you're going to see more and more stuff like this. As we already know, TVs are so thin that they can just about be pasted onto walls. So, you know, this idea of thinness and flexibility, it's going to be part of our television watching experience for the future.
Digital voice assistants. We have Amazon, we have Alexa, we have Google Home. What's the next step? Did you see anything new?
Well, there's the Kohler Numi Alexa toilet. And by the way, every time I say Alexa, my Alexa pipes up. but there is a toilet that has it built in. Now, it's interesting. I asked them because I saw it and it's got the blue lights around it. It's kind of pretty for a toilet. It's got the heated seat. But I asked them about flushing. And they said that, no, you can't use your voice to flush it right now. Which I'm like, well, what's the point?
Exactly. You know, like, what's the point? That's the whole thing.
You know, there's gesture control. I won't even go into it because there's a whole reason why you might want to flush while you're still sitting there. But you get the idea. That's still not what we need. But Alexa was literally everywhere. There were so many products because it's an open platform. People can easily integrate it with their technology, and they're doing it on clocks, on clock radios, on watch, you know, wherever they can think to put it, they're putting it. Microwaves, refrigerators, TVs, it's just all over the place. But what's interesting is that Google probably had the biggest presence at the show. They have the Home Assistant, Google Assistant, I should say, and they built a ride at CES, an actual ride. And it's so heavy and so big, they had to pour concrete to make sure that it would be supported. But it was like one of those people mover things at Disney World, and you saw, you know, how Google Assistant would change your life. And there were even animatronics inside of it. But they're not the leader in the space right now. Amazon is with Alexa. And Apple was there, but not there really, in that there were a lot of new products with HomeKit support, but they're still trailing far behind. And let's not forget Samsung and Bixby, because if you sit in a Samsung keynote at CES, they will talk about Bixby quite a bit. And if you have a Samsung product, you have it in there and you've probably never used it.
We're talking to Lance Yulinoff about all the cool things he saw at the Consumer Electronics Show. They don't call it that anymore. It's called CES. Robots. You know, I thought I was going to have a robot at home by now, a robot pet or a robot. Well, I do have a robot vacuum. But what's next in robots?
So more assistive robots. Samsung kind of dove in with a few of them, including BotCare, which is a robot that can even take your blood pressure. And it's very cute, cute face. But what really turned me on, got me excited, were the assistive robots, the exoskeletons called GEMS. They have different ones for ankle, for knee, for hip. I wore one that's for the hips, and basically it straps around your waist and then around your like just below your kneecaps. And it's lightweight, weighs like 4 pounds, but improves or increases your walking power by 20%. And that is a big deal. Whoa. When you walk around. You really feel it. And of course, it's not for, thankfully I'm able-bodied. It's not for me. It's for people who maybe are elderly, maybe have had a stroke, maybe have balance issues. And it's kind of incredible because it's not, when you think of exoskeletons, sometimes people think of like big and overbearing things. That's not this. So that's how robotics is going to impact our lives going forward. There were also a bunch of like cute, adorable robots out there that answer questions or respond to your touch. But they've all kind of struggled to break through. Last year, Sony reintroduced the Aibo. The Aibo was back at the show this year. It's a really cute robot dog, but it costs about $3,000, which is generally the reason why you don't have a C-3PO in your home yet.
Well, I encourage you to go check out Lance Ulanoff's Twitter feed. You can see one of those robotic cats. It looked pretty adorable.
It's true.
Lance writes the Upgrade Tech column for Medium. Lance, thank you so much for walking us through CES 2019.
Thanks for having me.
And that is it for our show. Thank you so much for listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We will definitely see you next time. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Ursula Summer, Simon Close, Jordan Lauf, and Pilar Belendez-Deshay. Matt Miranda is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It on Instagram and at Twitter at All of It WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll see you next time. I'm going to go to bed.